Listen, so thanks so much for speaking to us, James. Let's get started. The big tech, obviously in the news with the NSA, I wouldn't call them revelations. I mean, we knew they were happening, but I suppose it's brought it to the mass public, right? Boycott of them, are there alternatives? I mean, can people boycott the big tech companies illegally sharing our info with governments, and are there real alternatives, James?
Yeah.
There are real alternatives. There have been for decades now. When you look at something like the Free Software Foundation and the basically the movement to try to use open source software as alternatives to the type of proprietary software that's being vended by these large mega big tech corporations, which we now know are specifically in bed with the U.S. government in various ways. For example, the Google NSA relationship has been admitted, but a federal judge in federal district court ruled that relationship cannot be disclosed. No details can be disclosed of that relationship. Microsoft, there was an NSA access backdoor found in the Windows 2000 operating software in the source code back in 1999. So, and it goes on from there. I mean, we know that big tech is in bed with the government in numerous ways and has allowed access. So the Free Software Foundation and other similar organizations for decades now have been advocating for the basically open source software that people can see the code, see what's happening in the back end, fiddle with it if they want to, and run their own instantiations on their own hardware. So this is, I think, one of the promising ways that people can get around some of the problems that have been built into this software. The problem being that a lot of these problems have been built into the hardware as well. And in fact, we now know through things like the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act back in 1994, the CALIA Act, there was mandated to have backdoor access for federal law enforcement agencies in the United States, mandated into the hardware itself and the telecom systems in the back ends. So to a certain extent, you can fiddle with the software all you want, but if the hardware is being bugged and hacked, then it's a lot more difficult to get around. So this is something that basically is going to require a concerted effort from technologically inclined people, and also a concerted effort from the public to actually use and support these technologies, because like anything else, it's only as good as the people who are actually using it. And if you have a very small base, it's very difficult to get these types of technologies out there. There are solutions and ways around the internet wiretapping that we've seen. For example, there's something called wireless mesh networking, which is the idea of using basically your own devices as LAN routers that basically set up a local access network, which can link in with other people who are doing the same thing, and you could extend that network over hundreds of meters, hundreds of kilometers, even if you have enough people and enough density in that network. So some really amazing things can be done with this technology. It's just a question of people becoming aware of them and using them. And unfortunately, the political will to do so has not been there for most people for a long time. People have been basically okay with such things as the NSA and Google and NSA and Microsoft. But now that the awareness of the NSA is rising, I think there's a real opportunity to convince people that there is a reason to take that extra effort to learn about this technology and how to get around the big tech products that have been forced down people's throats.
Yeah, and another reason to change is William Hague, who's from my country, is famous for his blunders, but he said that you have nothing to fear if you're innocent, because Britain's as bad or worse at spying on people. But I read that psychologists have shown in tests that behavior changes when you know you're being spied on, say, online. Governments can and will use it against you when you do legitimate things like criticize the government, right? Let alone illegal snooping by individuals, because they're only human people working in the government. You know, that's been shown as well, James. So there are real, what I want to get at, if you agree, that even innocent people, completely innocent people who have nothing to hide, you don't want to be spied on, right?
There's no doubt about that. And in fact, this is a principle that's been known about for centuries. You can go back to the 18th century and British philosopher Jeremy Bentham, who wrote about the idea of a perfect prison called the panopticon, which was the idea of having a prison cell that was built in a circular fashion so that all of the cells would be on the outside. And in the center of the prison, you'd have a guard tower where the prisoners couldn't see into the guard tower. So they couldn't see if they were being watched by at any particular time. And so the prisoners would start to act as if they were were being watched at all times. And this is, I think, the type of system that benefits the people in positions of power and authority, because by that system, very few people or very few systems can effectively keep control of an entire population simply because they feel like they're being watched at all times, and people do modify their behavior accordingly. So I think that there is a deep psychological phenomenon that's going on here, and to a certain degree, even the revelations about what the NSA is doing does play into that agenda, because now there are people who realize they are being listened to and spied on at all times and are adjusting their speech accordingly. They might be afraid to speak on certain issues because even if they are innocent, they feel that it's wrong to speak out against the government. So unfortunately, it does feed into that fear and does make people adjust their behavior accordingly. But I think it shows the fundamental point that what the system really fears here is this type of technology being used not as a way of suppressing the population, but as a way of freeing it. And I think what we've seen with the development of the internet and the social media technologies that have been built up upon that internet platform is that the political power has devolved so much back down to the actual level of the people themselves. People don't need to go through the big mainstream media organizations to get their information. They don't need those middlemen in so many of their interactions that they're starting to really realize that, once again, political action, political change really does rest with the population. And the technology itself at least has the potential to enable that type of political change. So I think that's what the powers that currently reside in the top echelon of the status quo are really afraid of, is people using this technology for their own purposes. And when you start expanding that out to things like 3D printing and really revolutionary technologies that could truly revolutionize the way that people, for example, manufacture products, bringing that down to the desktop level, manufacturing things in your own home, could be a real threat to the status quo and the types of supply chains that have been built up over the preceding century or two of the Industrial Revolution. So we're on the cusp of a phenomenal societal change, and it's a question of whether or not they can get in all of their DRM technologies and their patent laws and all of this to try to suppress that, or if the people are going to use this technology to free themselves.
Yeah, on my Facebook, I posted a cartoon by Ted Rule, which showed a guy in 2001, just after September, saying in an airport being, you know, frisked and saying, oh, well, it's worth it for the extra security. And then another cartoon, 2011, all his calls being monitored and everything, you know, and the DNA being checked, everything. He said, it must be all worth it for safety. My point, do you agree that if we don't stop this, this is going to get worse and worse and worse, and they'll basically listen in to everything, right?
Well, unfortunately, from what I've talked with, for example, NSA whistleblower Russ Tice, they are actually recording everything. They are storing everything. They're not necessarily listening to everything, but of course they have that capability of cataloging, databasing, and bringing up any of the information that they need. If it's passed through electronic communications and the NSA can get their hands on it, they're storing it in Utah right now at their new data center. So we've already arrived at that level, and I think what's happening now is they're just sort of introducing these ideas to the public. And again, I think it's back to the public conditioning. If people can be made to accept this and to internalize this and simply to adjust their behaviors accordingly, I think that's the biggest threat to any type of popular action on this front. If people simply accept that they are being watched and then use that as an excuse not to go against the system, then unfortunately, I think that the power structure as it exists can really solidify and use this technology to repress political dissent.
Yeah, should we talk about Big Food? You called it a soft target. Why do you call it a soft target? How can people take maximum advantage of that weakness?
I think Big Food is a much softer target when it comes to this idea of boycotting the system than Big Tech, because everyone, I think, understands that the types of products that are being manufactured and produced in these factories and being passed off as food are not healthy. They're not good for you. The only thing that's good about them in any way is that they're convenient and they're relatively cheap. But I think people have an understanding, an innate understanding, that something that's coming out of a box that is colored funny colors and doesn't taste like real food is not something that they want to imbibe. So I think people have that sort of natural reaction to this product. Also, there's not the technological barriers. When it comes to big tech, you have to be at least somewhat tech savvy to be able to manipulate those technologies or to go around and set up alternative mesh networks and the like. When it comes to big food, all you have to have is a little few inches of garden space and the willingness and the know-how to basically raise some plants on your own. So I think it's something that anyone can get into. It's relatively easy to start doing, and it's the type of thing that brings people together. There are communities. There's already the infrastructure in so many communities for farmers markets, flea markets, local produce, sourcing this from people around you, participating in co-ops, in trading exchanges where people or even where people buy into, for example, raw milk, and everyone buys a portion of a cow, and the farmer delivers milk to them at a set time. There's a lot of this that already exists, so it's a very easy structure to tap into, and it's very easy for people to get started on. And I think, again, the political will and the motivation to do this is already there, because I think people already know, and the research continues to indicate, that a lot of these manufactured chemical-laden foods are simply health problems waiting to happen.
Yeah, that question I sent to James, how do such actions force corporations to change? So does history show that, let's say, big tech is boycotted and they start to see problems with their bottom line, less viewers means less advertising, that they will start to fight back against government and say, hey, we're not going to share this so easily with you, we want a warrant at least, blah, blah, blah. Does history show, because I know you've researched this subject, do you expect big tech to respond to public action like a boycott?
I wouldn't expect big tech to, per se. I think in the big tech arena, I think it's more likely that it will be the alternative infrastructure that the people can create that will be the real solution. I think that the big companies are already so firmly embedded within that structure that I don't think that they're ever going to fundamentally fight against it. But we do have examples, for example, from the big food paradigm, where you had a major reaction several years ago in the United States when they were attempting to use bovine growth hormone in milk products. And there was a lot of people who became very concerned about this, became politically motivated, aware, interested, and reacted against this, mobilized protest movements against this, and boycotts against some of the big name stores like Walmart and some of the other box stores that were selling this RBGH milk. And it actually resulted in this bovine growth hormone being removed from the milk. It's almost impossible to find bovine growth hormone milk now, even though that was becoming more and more the norm several years ago. So there are examples of where people have stood up and actually affected a change. And I think the more often that happens, the more likely people will be to realize that that is a real muscle that they have that they can flex when they want to.
Yeah. The fifth question that I sent to you about sort of generally government policy, because you can't boycott a government, but let's take, for example, this NSA scandal. Is there any boycott change that can make governments change their policies, say, for example?
Well, that's a very important question. But as you say, governments don't respond to boycotts. But maybe I'll argue with that position, because I think that there are ways that people can withdraw their consent from the system at the very least. Of course, that's the basis of civil disobedience, is withdrawing your consent and putting yourself in the way of a system that is being oppressive. And we've seen how that has played out in so many different successful social revolutions in the past. And I think that the next stage of that type of revolution would be ultimately the withdrawing of consent from the so-called democratic process in these countries, whereby what's really running the United States at this point is not the government per se that people vote for, not the elected representatives, but the people who are controlling the national security apparatus, which is working behind this smokescreen, this cloud of national security secrets. And I think people understand there's a shadow government, but how do you affect that? I think it has to come from withdrawing your consent from the democratic processes that claim to be the ruling authority in, for example, the United States context. And that comes from having more people not voting in an election than voting is a clear sign that that there is that withdrawal of consent. And when we start to reach those types of levels and people are either writing in none of the above or withdrawing from the voting process altogether, I think you can start to see that there's a type of way that you can boycott government policies to at least get it to respond to what's happening. When it loses the legitimization that comes from these phony elections that are put on every 4 years, I think people will start to understand that the system itself really does lack the authority to rule over the country.
It was just in short, you fascinated me with this shadow government idea that national security apparatus runs it. I know that Barack Obama bows to the CIA. He's on record as saying the CIA gets what it wants, which is why it goes out of control with these wars and drones and everything. Because apparently he worked for CIA or something. I don't know why. But just in short, could you explain as briefly as possible how the U.S. I know that the corporations sponsor governments and they sort of control government policy, but just a few words about the national security apparatus and how and why it controls the government.
In 1947, the National Security Act basically created a reason for government agencies to hide behind the screen of national security as a way of cloaking their actions. And this is where the CIA was actually born from. And it was because of that cloud, that smokescreen that they're able to put up, that they are able to go off the books into their black budgets and to perform operations that the American people don't know about. There is supposedly oversight from Congress over these types of things in closed-door meetings, etc., through people who have security clearances. But in reality, once you have established these agencies that are allowed to operate off the books and off budget, there's really no control in the democratic sense over these institutions. So they become de facto mini-governments in and of themselves. And we saw that from the very inception of the CIA, which of course went on to overthrow Mossadegh in Iran in the 1950s, and from there on in, continuing to overthrow democratically elected governments around the world, oftentimes without the explicit approval of people in political power and without the knowledge of people in the general public. So that's an example of what happens, and it leads to things like, for example, in the 1980s, the largest on the record, at any rate, CIA operation in Afghanistan, where they pumped billions of dollars into funding the freedom fighters in Afghanistan, as they were referred to at the time, which of course became the Al-Qaeda terrorists of later years. So these types of operations continue to go on at completely out of the sight and out of the mind of the general public. And they have a more direct effect on the things that the government is doing and what is being done in the American people's name than what is being done by the politicians on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, for me, sixth question. I mean, for me, it's absolutely shocking what's going on at the moment in the U.S. I mean, well, I think it's in many countries. I think maybe just the U.S. has got more whistleblowers. But the complete control, and we use these words too freely, but I think they're true, the Stasi, the police state, and all this. What will happen, James, if we don't stop this? I mean, presumably it will get worse.
That's basically it. I mean, I think what we've seen over the past 70 years or so has been the gradual encroaching of this national security apparatus over the American government. And of course, you're right, it's in the context of basically every country on the planet has similar intelligence apparatuses. But it leads to the point where you literally have, for example, former CIA director George H.W. Bush becomes president of the country. What does that mean that the former chief intelligence agent or the head of the intelligence agency of the country suddenly finds himself in the position of president? Doesn't that give the shadow government both the sort of behind the scenes control as well as the overt control? Of course it does. And I think that type of the unmasking of the national security apparatus and how it controls the country only becomes more overt as this process gets further and further on, until you've got the point where the CIA now openly performs military-style operations with their drone wars, and there's no one who can really rein it in, as you were indicating there in your question.
Yeah, so the question, if done correctly, how powerful and effective can the boycott be?
It can be, truly, it is the only possible solution for fundamentally transforming the society. I think that there are a lot of cosmetic changes that can be made. There are a lot of laws that can be passed to try to reform this or that corporation or this or that industry, or to try to put hampers on what can be done. But I think all of that is cosmetic. I think to fundamentally strike at the root of the issue, the people once again have to understand that the power really does come from their consent and their willingness to go along with the system. And when they withdraw that, whether that be from a specific company or from a specific industry or from the government at large or whatever context that's in, when they withdraw their consent and actually put themselves out there to protest against what's happening en masse, it can truly change the course of history. And we've seen this time and again with all sorts of movements, whether it be Gandhi bringing down the British Empire in India or the civil rights movement in the United States, or all sorts of protest movements that started out sometimes as boycotts or pickets against the Montgomery Bus Company or things of that nature that can have truly world-changing effects. So again, I think people have to stop focusing on the long-term goals and start focusing on what they can do in their everyday lives. And I think once people start to understand that they really do have that political power in their own hands, I think that's the type of time when we will see that type of change of society.
Yeah, finally, the newspapers, we call it in journalism, for this story, is the success of the Bipa app. Any thoughts on the success of that app? It's been incredibly successful. How it should be used?
I don't know about the app specifically, but I can speak to the idea of the technology itself being an enabling factor in all of this, because I think the technology is going to be the key to the next stage of this type of boycott protest. I think that boycotts in the past have necessarily been haphazard and loosely coordinated, but the technology that exists now, especially this social media technology, etc., that has brought people together on an unprecedented scale, really does open up that possibility for concerted political action, the likes of which the world has just never seen before. So I think it does exist this window of opportunity whereby people can come together on an unprecedented scale using the technology that in many ways is surveilling and tracking them, but still using that against the system that's attempting to oppress them. And I think that we haven't even begun to imagine the possibilities of what can result from this.
Yeah, really great. Anything else you would like to add, Jeff?
Not that I can think of, really. Just basically my message is that once again, it does really rest in the hands of the people. And I think people just don't understand the power that they do have, because for decades, they've been programmed into thinking that they're basically unimportant, they're inconsequential, that all political action happens in the capital, in Washington, in London, in Moscow. But once people start to realize that really, truly, in their own lives, they have so much power over what they invest their time, their money, and their energy in doing, in interacting with, is exactly what type of society they end up having. So if they continue to buy big tech and big food and go along with all of the status quo systems as usual, and then expect that political lobbying is somehow going to reform those for the better, I think that they've lost the battle by default. It's only when they realize that by striking at the very root of the problem, by refusing to give their own time and their own money and their own energy to those processes, that they'll understand that that once again, it does rest in their hands.
Yeah, it's fascinating to talk to you. Listen, go and get a good night's sleep. I think you deserve it. Thanks again.
Thank you so much. All right, take care.